From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with musician Joe King Carrasco. His music is Tex-Mex, a mix of rock and roll, Chicano, and Latin American influences. Also today, I'll speak with composer John Adams. He's been described as the leading composer in the second wave of minimalism. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward digs out some old recordings by The Creation, one of the best but one of the least known of the British art school bands. And book critic John Leonard reviews Sphere, the latest suspense novel by best-selling author Michael Crichton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Joe King Carrasco. He plays an updated version of Tex-Mex music. Tex-Mex is a fusion of rock and roll and Chicano music that developed around the American-Mexican border. To those sounds, he's added new wave and rhythms he's picked up on his travels through Central and South America. Carrasco made his reputation playing party music. Since his recent extended trip to Nicaragua, he's written political lyrics to some of his songs. He had a hit in Nicaragua, but ironically, it was his version of an old novelty song about how everyone loves to eat bananas. Carrasco plays guitar and sings lead vocals with his band Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns. Before we meet him, this is Chicano Town from the Crowns' new album, Bandido Rock. That's Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns, who now call themselves Joe King Carrasco y las Coronas.
Sí.
Joe, welcome to Fresh Air.
I'm glad to be here.
Terrific music. You know, your music makes me think that there still is such a thing as regionalism in rock and roll. Sometimes I think that formatted rock radio has homogenized things so much that there isn't regional music anymore.
And it still exists. I mean, for me, in South Texas, you can still hear it on the Chicano radio. I mean, if you turn on the FM dial, you'll hear like a rock and roll station, a country station, and Chicano station. And all three of them, you know, still seem to have a little bit of regionalism in them. But basically, the Chicano music's really sort of outside of all that, and it really is regional music.
Is it hard to have a regional sound and make it nationally at the same time?
I think so, but I think that I always have hope that it would, and we do really good in Europe with it. I mean, in Europe they love Tex-Mex, and so I keep doing it.
You were on a major record label for a while.
Yeah.
Did they want you to become more ironed out, more mainstream?
Yeah, I think they wanted us to be, you know, like, you know, the next plastic on the shelf. And like, for an example, I had a song called Send Your Lover, and I thought the lyrics would be really neat to talk about how people come across from Mexico over to, you know, Texas, you know, illegal aliens, right? And one of the guys said, well, I don't think people in New York would understand that question, you know. So things like that kind of kept down. But now I can do it.
You actually had Michael Jackson sing backups with you on one of the records you recorded.
Yeah.
How did that happen? This was before his Thriller record, before he became as big as he became.
It was pretty wild. We were in the same studio. This when I was on MCA, you know, we shared the same studio with the Jackson 5, and they're in the next room, and I kind of think they probably thought I was a little strange. I'm not sure, but he turned out to be a real nice guy, and I'd see him sitting there every day just looking into the space, and so I started bringing my Walkman, you know, listen to tapes and stuff like that, and then I was real curious, you know, when I talked to him, I always liked Bob Marley, and he played with Bob Marley, so I was always asking about Bob Marley, and I guess he realized that I wasn't really, you know, trying to get to him or anything, but then one day I said, why don't you come in and sing a harmony on this song, and he said, sure, so I showed him the song, and he sang Don't Let a Woman, and he's really a nice guy. You know, he really is. He's got a great voice. He's definitely got a gift from God.
You can't hear him a lot on your record.
I think they brought his voice down because they thought we were going to try to commercialize his voice. I don't know.
Right.
But it was really, you know, it was real neat for me to sing with him.
Did you play in a lot of Chicano bands before you started your own band?
Yeah, a lot. I used to substitute myself out on guitar to a lot of Chicano bands. And for a long time, I played with a band called Shorty and the Corvettes, another band called Salomon, and just a lot of different conjuntos. You know, groups of accordion. And I really loved it. I mean, it was like, you know, for me, it was wonderful. It was like, you know, even though it was in Texas, South Texas, it was still like, it was like being in Mexico for me. Or it was, sometimes it was like being out of a Sam Peckinpah movie or something. It was really wonderful.
Did the musicians rib you a lot for being the white person in the band, the gringo in the band?
You know, kind of. That's, you know, they call me Carrasco. And they, if you know, they, at first, for a while, I'm thinking, wonder if I was a narcotic agent or something, you know. Or, I mean, it's, you know. But, They really respect me for it, and I guess they had never seen a gringo try to learn their kind of music, because Latinos have a tendency to think that nobody's interested in their culture, and I kind of think it confused them that I was. I love Chicano music. I think it's really wonderful. I think that the Latin culture is the future of the United States in terms of new things coming. It's taken over.
We know in the first piece of music that we heard, there's some really prominent accordion,
yeah.
And it sounds so great. Accordion is one of the instruments I grew up thinking I didn't like because of the setting I always heard it in,
yeah.
And I've started to really love the instrument.
It's beautiful. I mean, a lot of people, you know, they tend to put down the accordion, but if you go to northern Mexico and you're in a canteen and drinking some ice and you're having a good time and it's beautiful music, then I've always been aware of that. Then I went down to Colombia, and the basic music of Colombia is accordion music. It's called vallenato music, and that's what I listen to now. And Marquez listens to it, you know, the author. You know,
Gabriel Garcia.
Yeah. And he listens to it, and that's his favorite kind of music. Mm-hmm. And if you play accordion in Colombia, you're king. And so it's the hippest thing to do is play accordion. So that's why I like it.
What was the music you grew up listening to? You grew up in Texas in the Panhandle.
Yeah. I grew up listening to rock and roll there, but it seemed like the groups that stuck to my mind, you know, the groups that I liked were like Question Mark and Mysterians and Sir Douglas Quintet and Sam the Sham. And weird enough, all these bands were all from Texas, which I never thought of. You know, when you're a kid growing up, the last thing you think about is regionalism. You just like the songs you hear. But I always liked Wooly Bully, and I like 96 Tears, and like She's About a Mover, and all those groups. And it turned out they were all from Texas. So I started, you know, looking into them more and more, and I found out these were all bands that were consisted of mostly Latinos. And Sam the Sham would include some Tex-Mex on his records, and that's when I started getting into it. I thought, if these are my favorite bands and they're doing it, then I should do it, you know. And it's easier if you grow up in an area, if you play what you know of what that area is about, then I think you feel more comfortable doing what you're doing. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I do know what you mean. You mentioned Question Mark and the Mysterians as being one of your influences.
Yeah.
And 96 Tears has, I don't know, maybe the greatest Farfisa organ line in all of rock and roll. And you have used great Farfisa organ on some of your records. And in a previous band, you had a lot of Farfisa organ.
Yeah, it was all Farfisa. I mean, I used to be a Farfisa addict. I mean, if it wasn't organ, I didn't listen to it. In fact, my guitar player now in the band used to play in 96, he wrote 96 Tears.
Well, I want to ask you about that after this, but I want to play a great record of yours. This is an earlier record.
Yeah.
And it has a great Farfisa line, very similar to the 96 Tears line.
Yeah.
This is Houston El Mover. Do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
It's about how all the girls look great in Houston, I think. I'm not sure. It's just a fun song, you know.
Now, let's hear it. This is Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns.
Well, I get high when I get to Houston. I get high when I see that girl. I get high when I get to Houston. I get high when I see that girl. She's a Houston Elmola. Houston good looker. Houston Elmola. Oh, she moves so fast. Houston Elmola, Houston good looker, Houston Elmova, how she moves so fast. All around the world, all the same, crazy people, faces and things. Down in Houston in an uptown scene, it's the best girl I ever did meet. She's a Houston Elmova, Houston good looker, Houston Elmova, how she moves so fast. She's a Houston Elmova, Houston good looker, Houston Elmova, how she moves so fast. I get high when I get to Houston. I get high when I see that girl. I get high when I get to Houston. I get high when I see that girl. She's a Houston Elmova, Houston good looker, Houston Elmova. Oh, she moves so fast. She's a Houston Elmova, Houston good looker, Houston Elmova. Oh, she moves so fast.
Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns, and that was Houston Elmover. And what a great Farfisa line. And it's really a great recording.
I love it. It's what I'm about.
You grew up in Texas, and you're still based in Texas, although I know you travel around the Americas most of the time. You were telling me that there's still a lot of regionalism in Texas, and that you can actually hear where a band is from, depending on how they play.
Well, I mean, if you ever listen to, you know, Texas music, remember this song, I Fought the Law and the Law Won?
Sure, yeah.
And Bob, that was from El Paso. That's the El Paso sound. And then there's Roy Orbison came from Odessa, the area. You know, where the tornado just hit around there. And then Lubbock, you had Buddy Holly sound. It's a Northwest Texas sound, Joe Ely. And then in Dallas, you had more of the blues sound. Dallas-Fort Worth, you had Boss Gag, Steve Miller, and Stevie Ray Vaughan there, and the Thunderbirds are from the Dallas area. And then from Houston, you had the ZZ Top kind of sound, more rock and roll. Plus, they had a lot of rhythm and blues sounds that came out of Houston. And they had the kind of the bayou sound, like from Beaumont, and like Clifton Chenier and all that. That kind of music comes from around Houston and Beaumont. Then if you go into South Texas, you get, you know, the capital of South Texas is definitely San Antonio. And that's where Sir Douglas Quintet came from. And that's where it's the home of Latin music. All the way down the border, you hear all that Latin sound. And what Tex-Mex sort of combines all those Latin sounds and mixes them up with, you know, rock and roll or blues or whatever.
But what would you call your sound? Is it regional within Texas?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, you know, lean towards San Antonio. I think the Latin edge is more what I'm about with. And I think, I mean, to me, if you want to get on the roots of Texas, Texas was belonged to Mexico before anybody else. So let's face it, Texas is Mexico. So that's the music I'm doing, Tex-Mex.
We were talking before about playing with Chicano bands, which is how you started out. When you decided to form your own band, you called yourself Joe King Carrasco. First of all, your original name, your birth name isn't Carrasco. So, tell us how you got the name Carrasco and also how you added King to it.
Yeah, okay. From the first Chicano bands I played with, they, you know, last name was Toich. My family was like a South Texas German family. And it's real strange. I think a lot of the South Texas Germans have a lot in common with the Chicanos or somehow in the music heritage. I'm not sure. Even Sir Douglas Quintet, Doug Somm, is German. But anyway, so around that same time that I started out playing Latin Chicano bands, Fred Carrasco, have you heard of him? He broke out of Huntsville Penitentiary.
Oh.
Fred Carrasco was like the number one bandit in South Texas. I mean, he was a very heavy guy in all manners of the word. I mean, he was big in Mexico and South Texas, and he was the longest prison siege in Texas history, and he was a big hero. I mean, 3 days after he was killed, there was all these corridos, you know, songs in Spanish about him, And so a friend of mine named Bender Marinas, he said, I'm going to call you Carrasco. And from then on, it stuck. You know, so I got to be called Carrasco. And I was always, and then I always liked, you know, Sam the Sham and Sir Douglas Quintet. And I thought, well, you know, when I started having my own band going, I thought, well, I could be Count Carrasco. Then somebody said, no, King Carrasco sounds better. So I said, King, you know. But I'm really only a king of manana. That's about it.
Did you get yourself a crown?
Yeah, I had a crown. I mean, crowns in South Texas, it's real neat. They're into crowns. I think, you know, all through, even down through the Caribbean, they're, like all the bands in Trinidad, there's either a prince or there's a king. They always wear crowns. Plus, I like Clifton Chenier a whole lot, and he wore a crown. And, you know, so I kind of adopted that.
So you still wear it when you perform?
Well, sometimes, yeah, I do. It's hard. You know, I lose them a lot. Somebody just stole the one I have. But so I've been getting some crowns from Mexico that are made from tin cans that are really neat looking, you know. I know that sounds crazy, but it's like they're Mexican folk art, you know, they make crowns down there.
That sounds neat. Well, Joe, we're going to take a short break.
Okay.
We'll be back in a few seconds. My guest is musician Joe King Carrasco. He leads his own band, Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Joe King Carrasco is my guest. His band, Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns, plays Tex-Mex music, which is a hybrid of rock and roll and Chicano music. They also travel a lot around the world, and Joe's traveled a lot through Central America and South America, and they have a new album called Bandito Rock. You really made your reputation playing party music, but you recently started writing political lyrics to some of your songs. What changed you around?
Well, I've always been pretty aware of the political situation in Latin America and everything, and I feel that, you know, as long as you have a beat and you're having fun on stage, you can pretty much say what you want to say as long as it's, you know, danceable. And after, you know, I've been traveling in Latin America so long, I felt it was time to really speak out about what I've been seeing down there, because I used to go to Honduras a lot before, you know, the trouble, you know, before they had the Marines there and everything. And Honduras used to be a really nice, innocent place where the people were really friendly. Now it's turned into like a little Saigon where there's lots of drugs everywhere now, and there's prostitution's taking place. I mean, it's being corrupted by American dollars, which is real sad, and it's destroying the culture there. And I have to speak up about it. You know, it's the reality of what's going on down there, and it's not right.
The impression I get is that when you're traveling through Central America or South America, two of the things you like to do is listen to local bands and then perform there and see what kind of reaction you get. Let's talk about some of the bands that you've heard in your travels. In Nicaragua, for instance, where you were there for an extended amount of time, what kind of music did you hear?
The music in Nicaragua, The thing that's happening now is there's a group from Bluefields. There's a bunch of Caribbean bands from the Bluefields. It's on the Caribbean side, and they're black, but they have Latin influences too. And like their big hit now, like number one song in Nicaragua this last year, was called Money Money. I mean, this is a song that Reagan says it's a communist country, and the number one song is called Money Money Money. Everybody like money, 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 money. Everybody want money, and they're a great band, and they're real. It's almost calypso. It's got a real Latin influence to it, and I love that band, the bands that, you know, do all that stuff, and that's why I go down and listen to, because what they do there is they mix Latin music with black music, and it's sort of like real Caribbean-style music. You can always find something in it.
You had a hit record in Nicaragua. You told me that they're still playing it on the radio there, but it's not a political song at all.
Well, it is. The Banana song.
Is it political?
Well, I didn't write it. I rewrote the new lyrics to it and everything, but the thing is, I heard it, you know, when I first went to Managua, here's a country that's in a war. I mean, it's a serious war that's going on down there, but people there seem to be happy. And in a discotheque one night, I heard, actually, I wasn't in discotheque because they wouldn't let me in discotheque because I had shorts on, but I heard it outside the walls. And I heard this song about bananas, how all the nations like bananas. And I thought, God, here's a place where people should be really miserable, and everybody loves this song about how everybody likes bananas. If you know, you can be a Cuban and like bananas, you can be a Republican and like bananas, but one thing we have in common is we all like bananas. If we disagree on everything else, we like bananas. So I thought, that's really beautiful. I mean, in times of, you know, hard times, it's good to find something in common.
So that's what made you want to record it yourself?
Yeah, it's neat to see how people agree that we all like bananas, if anything.
How did the record get airplay in Nicaragua?
Well, I mean, when I was down there, I took it around the first time. And I know when I was going to school there, I took it around the stations and stuff. We also took the song Fuera Yankee down there, too, and they played that a lot.
We're going to play Banana, which all is right. The song that was the big hit in Nicaragua, which is also featured on your new album,
yeah.
Bandito Rock.
In the accordion style that in this song comes from Colombia, it's kind of a vallenato style.
Which is what?
It's an accordion style from Colombia. You know, it's got a lot of Colombian influence.
Okay, let's give it a listen. Banana from the new Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns album, Bandito Rock.
Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah, how do you learn how to do that?
I learned all. You know, I mean, it's funny. You can be playing in a Chicano bar or a Mexican bar, and you, all of a sudden out of the back you'll hear, ay, ay, ay. You know, somebody just going crazy. It's really fun. I love that.
Yeah, you can really roll those R's also.
Sometimes.
You have to work on that?
Yeah, do something. It depends on how I'm feeling.
What about your stage style? You have a pretty wild stage style, and you do this whole lasso thing with the microphone.
Yeah.
How does that go over in Latin America?
Oh, when we played Bolivia, like I said, they kind of flipped them out a little bit because they thought, golly, what's going on here? But, I mean, I feel that if you're on stage and you're playing exciting music or any kind of music, you should jump around and really have fun. To me, rock and roll is movement and dancing around. I don't think the performer should be still if they don't feel like it. And I don't like to, you know, be still. I think a lot of action is important.
As we mentioned before, you grew up in Texas. And you're a white man.
Alemana. It's German.
German. Okay. Do you feel that Latin music speaks to your roots at all? Because you play it with the fervor of someone who really grew up steeped in it.
Well, that, like I say, on the origins of Tex-Mex, you want to hear that?
Sure.
They say that Tex-Mex, that, you know, they're pure... form of Tex-Mex came from around northern Mexico, around Monterrey. It's the northern part of Mexico. And the way it came about was a lot of Germans and a lot of Europeans came to northern Mexico when they discovered silver there. And they brought their music with them, the polkas from, you know, Europe and the German music. And what happened was a lot of the campesinos heard this music and they sort of adopted it to their own style. And at the when the Mexican Revolution took place, a lot of the Mexicans migrated to Texas. And that's how it crept up into Texas, you know, around San Antonio. So that's how it came about, basically. That's one of the theories. And it seems logical to me. Today in South Texas at night, you can hear this radio station out of Monterrey called Rancheras de Monterrey. And it's a great, it's all my main radio station that I listen to. And you can hear, like, it's a real neat station because you can hear, they take requests, right? So somebody in Texas who's, you know, migrated, you know, from Mexico to Texas, they can't go back to Mexico because they won't be able to come back into Texas, right? Because they don't have their papers. And so what they'll do is they'll send messages out to their loved ones in Mexico through the radio station.
Huh.
It's a great thing, you know.
You have always worn a crown in your performances.
Corona, yeah.
Right. And it's Joe King Carrasco.
Yeah.
Does that seem elitist to you now that you've become more politicized?
Well, I mean, I do it in fun, you know. I mean, like I said, I'm the king of mañana. I do it in a way where you have fun and you mimic it. You know, I'm definitely not a king of anything, you know. But I think it's a lot of fun. It's kind of in England. I was got arrested in front of Buckingham Palace wearing this crown shooting a video, and I almost got deported from England for wearing it because they thought I insulted the Queen. And then it was kind of weird to have it around Northern Ireland when we played Belfast. It was just kind of I was a little paranoid around there with it. You know, so it's what can you say? So I'm gonna the crown that I've been wearing is an English crown. I'm gonna change over to, like I say, the Mexican crowns. They don't really stand for anything. They're made from cans of jalapenos, right?
So do you feel your music is heading in any new directions now?
Well, I like to do in the protest stuff a whole lot. It seems a lot of people really like the protest stuff, and not that it's protest music, but it's music that I feel that a lot of people should become more informed about what's going on in Latin America. And it's funny, we had the song Hey Gringo, No Pastoran, and we went down to Bolivia and played it. They really liked the song because the Marines had just been there on the drug eradication campaign, and the Bolivians really felt insulted seeing the Americans come down there and try to tell them how to, you know, run their country, and they loved that song. So I want to try to write more music that will relate to more Latin audiences, but then again, I also want to write songs that relate to the experience of why I got into Latin music in the first place. Like, I want to write songs about San Antonio or the musicians who are my heroes. Things that, you know, that I can write with passion.
Joe, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. It's been fun to have you here.
Yeah. Ow!
My guest has been Joe King Carrasco, and his band Joe King Carrasco y Las Coronas has a new album called Bandito Rock on the Rounder record label. This is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll talk with singer-songwriter and humorist Loudon Wainwright. He'll perform, and we'll talk about his life, so I hope you can join us. Here's some more music by Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with composer John Adams. He's working on a three-act opera about Nixon's visit to China, and he has a new album called The Chairman Dances. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward introduces us to the short-lived British art school band, The Creation. Book critic John Leonard reviews Michael Crichton's latest novel, Sphere, and we'll have a news update from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Here's the news. This is Fresh Air. Three members of the band Talking Heads, David Byrne, Tina Weymouth, and Chris Franz, first met when they were students at the Rhode Island School of Design. But they were hardly the first rock musicians playing music when they were supposed to be painting. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, is going to tell us about a group called The Creation. They didn't stay together long, but Ed thinks their music was inspired.
My coat is sweet. Can I join your band? I'm a hippie guy. Always stoned in my heart.
The British invasion would have been nothing if it hadn't been for art school. Art school, as John Lennon would have been happy to tell you, was where you went if you were smart but too much of a goof-off to make the grade for the university. Art school bands were particularly important in the second wave of the British invasion. There were the Kinks, with Ray Davies' mordant pictures of the social mores of Britain, The Who, with their fashion sense and obsession with identity, and The Move, who seemed to be all looming bass and exploding drums. As the Beatles took more liberties and the pop world discovered Bob Dylan discovering himself, boy-girl songs and bright, cheery melodies began to be overshadowed by a more abstract aesthetic. One band from this wave that's been overlooked, nearly forgotten, even by real obsessives, was The Creation, a band that I think was making music that equaled that of The Who or The Move in 1967. And I'm not alone in thinking that. I know Pete Townsend of The Who was a big fan. But try and find out anything about them. I know that their guitarist was Eddie Phillips and their vocalist was Kenny Pickett, that John Dalton, their first bass player, left to join the Kinks in 1966, and that when Eddie quit in 1968, he was replaced by Ron Wood, who went on to the Faces and the Rolling Stones. The Creation possessed a remarkable balance of sensibilities, as this song, How Does It Feel, makes plain, being a sort of cross between pop and heavy metal. Maybe they were just ahead of their times, because as far as I can discern, they never had a hit in England, although they had some success in Europe. Despite being managed by Tony Stratton Smith, who later masterminded Genesis, and despite having their records produced by Shel Talmy, who produced the Kinks, and despite a whale of a stage show, at the end, Kenny Pickett spray-painted their backdrop and set it on fire, while Eddie Phillips played his guitar with a violin bow years before Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page thought of it, The Creation remains a footnote in British rock history. Here's their biggest hit, the song where Eddie and Kenny give their thoughts on art school, Painter Man.
Start. Studied hard, gained my degree. to notice me.
Eddie left the band in 1969 and was last seen driving a bus in London. Kenny was rumored to have made a record with Nick Lowe in 1976, and drummer Jack Jones has disappeared. Too bad. It was some creation while it lasted.
Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is composer John Adams. He's been hailed by critics as one of the most exciting contemporary composers to build on the innovations of the first minimalist composers like Terry Riley, Philip Glass, and Steve Reich. His music is widely performed, and he has been both a musical advisor and composer in residence with the San Francisco Symphony. He's currently working on a grand opera called Nixon in China that premieres in October. It's set in 1972 at the time President Nixon visited China. The title composition of Adams' new album, The Chairman Dances, includes a piece that grew out of the opera. I asked John Adams about the ideas behind his composition, The Chairman Dances.
It was inspired from a scene in Act 3 of the opera that I'm writing, Nixon in China. During Act 3, we are present at the final banquet which the Americans threw for the Chinese. This is after 3 days of intensive speech-making and sightseeing and political talking, and everyone is pretty burnt out. The only person who seems to have any gusto in the scene is Madame Mao, who walks on stage, no longer dressed as a communist, but in her former identity as a Chinese movie star. She's dressed very glamorously with stiletto heels. She goes over to the orchestra and tells them to play a different tune, a foxtrot, and she summons Chairman Mao down from his poster on the wall, and the two of them do a foxtrot and relive their early romance in Yunnan during the 1940s, and they foxtrot off into the night.
I think your music is very infectious, and I wonder if that's ever a mixed blessing for you. I'm thinking that it might be suspect in some serious new music circles.
Well, I think this particular album, The Chairman Dances, presents perhaps a somewhat lighter side of my musical personality. I have other records which are somewhat darker and somewhat more mercurial or emotional, pieces like Harmony Lehrer or Harmonium. I've been attacked from all sides. I've been attacked for the accessibility of my music. And that's an interesting fact and point, that music in the 20th century has become so divorced from its public that it's expected of a composer that he be inaccessible. And I think that this is indicative of a tremendous state of misunderstanding that the arts have arrived at by 1980. And I take my inspiration very much from the 19th century composers who were able to compose great works of art that were still accessible on the first hearing.
I want to ask you about your piece Short Ride in a Fast Machine, which is one of two fanfares on your new album. The rhythms on it are very catchy, very contagious, but there are so many different rhythms going simultaneously that when I listen, I find each of my hand and feet trying to beat out conflicting rhythms.
That's right. Well, my music really comes from a sense of pulsation, and I think that's really the essence of the American musical experience. What makes me differ from a lot of composers of my generation is that I try to incorporate different periods of pulsation within the music. So instead of a single mind-numbing repeated pulse, my music is a kind of combination of different layers of pulsation, and I think that adds to the tension and the excitement of the music.
A 20th century music series in San Francisco called New and Unusual Music. I know that many symphonies are afraid that music will scare off audiences, and the way I understand it, your programs have gotten excellent attendance. What did you do to get such a good turnout?
Well, the idea behind the New and Unusual series was to use the immense prestige and influence and money that a major symphony orchestra has to try to promote a series of concerts that were geared towards a new repertoire and also admittedly geared towards a new audience. One of the perceptions I had when I went to symphony concerts to hear my own music or other music was that I never saw anyone my own age there. I never saw anyone that I knew. and this disturbed me greatly. So we set about to design this concert series that was very flexible in its format, that could allow for electronic music or for music that was highly amplified or music that involved theater, all the things that a standard symphony orchestra is simply unequipped to handle. And we also took these concerts outside of the very staid and respectable concert hall and had them in different venues around town, some which even looked almost like nightclubs. It was an experiment that worked for a while. Recently, the attendance has dropped off dramatically, and the programming has changed a great deal. The structure of a symphony is really a corporate structure, and it really should be in the business of promoting orchestral music, and that the kind of concerts that I'm talking about really, really should be in the hands of different institutions that are there to promote contemporary art, contemporary music.
You left academia. You didn't stay on for a doctorate of music. Was the training too orthodox for you?
I have no complaints about my training, and my teachers were very good. What I noticed while I was at college was that the professors of mine who were composers were desperately strung out between their roles as professors and their creative roles, and only a very, very rare person can straddle that dichotomy and maintain an important relationship to his or her art. And I felt that for me, the real motivating force was to do just my art and nothing else.
Are you busy preparing now for your opera, Nixon in China?
I'm about halfway through the orchestration, which is a very, very long, arduous undertaking where I write each individual orchestral part out on a score, and then someone copies that into a part for each player. So I'm writing approximately 5,300 bars of orchestral music within the next 3 months.
What's it like to be working under a deadline? Is that helpful for you?
Normally, it's a tremendous beneficial tension that I like. I'm sort of like Mozart in that I can't conceive of writing a piece of music unless there is a deadline. However, at the moment, I find this tension almost unbearable, and I wish I could push the deadline back about 3 or 4 months, but I can't, so I'm having to learn to live with it.
Well, I wish you the best with it.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you very much for talking
with
us.
Sure, it's been a pleasure.
John Adams' new album is called The Chairman Dances. In October, the Houston Grand Opera will premiere his opera, Nixon in China. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Well, we're following President Reagan's remarks. He was on the Hill today, Capitol Hill. Members of Congress spoke to him, and reporters asked about a smoking gun that might prove his knowledge of the diversion of funds to supply the Contras. Quote, said the president, ain't no smoking gun, unquote. Also, we'll be covering Citibank's announcement that it's pulling out of South Africa.
What are those sounds I hear creeping up behind us?
Ah, those are the sounds of baby herons feeding, because we're going to have a report tonight on the herons who return every year to Maryland.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Michael Crichton's first bestseller, The Andromeda Strain, was published in 1969, the same year he received a degree in medicine from Harvard. Since then, Crichton's written several bestsellers and directed both TV and feature films. His latest book is a science fiction novel called Sphere. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
From the author of The Andromeda Strain and The Terminal Man, we don't really expect character. Michael Crichton finds his characters on the backs of cereal boxes and parades them around like sandwich boards. Thus, in Sphere, the scientists who face death and destruction aren't people so much as they are recipes that add up to predictable emotions. The zoologist is an angry and disappointed feminist. The mathematician is an angry and disdainful black man. The astrophysicist is a G. Willikers pinup boy Carl Sagan type. The psychologist is an overweight self-doubter who worries about everybody else's feelings. And the Navy commander in charge of their mission is a militaristic nitwit. All these recipes go overboard and underwater, 1,000 feet below the surface of the turbulent South Pacific, to breathe exotic gas and drink isotonic glucose supplement and look into a spaceship that seems to have crash-landed about 300 years ago. There they will be attacked by thimble-sized jellyfish in clouds of pink snow, by shrimps without stomachs, by a bad-tempered giant squid, and by psychic projections of their own bad faith. This spaceship proves to be American, but from our future. It skipped in time through the back door of a black hole, and along the way picked up the Sphere, a huge ball bearing full of fireflies. The Sphere talks to the scientists through their computer. It calls itself Jerry. Jerry's a lot of fun so long as he remains mysterious. So is Michael Crichton fun, so long as he's dreaming out loud about alien life instead of going inside to explain its plumbing. The scientists spend many pages trying to imagine an intelligent other. Since we can't really even talk to one of our own dolphins, how would we talk to an alien reptile, a big insect, a thinking crystal, a mental enzyme, or a virus from a different star? It might be blind and see the world through smell, or temperature, or pressure. It might communicate in odors. It might exhale cyanide gas and excrete radioactive waste and give off bone-shattering sound vibrations. It might have more than three dimensions. It might even be immortal, like a single-celled bacterium or yeast. What if we can't kill it? That's a lot to think about, especially when the fireflies get fancy in their humming foam, and the scientists are plagued by ghosts and personality disorders, and Jerry has an extraterrestrial temper tantrum, and most of the U.S. Navy is dead. While Crichton is bouncing his ideas off his technology, we duck and run for cover, and the exercise is wonderful for our paranoia. When, unfortunately, he has to stop and make sense, what we get is gloomy metaphysics in one of Carl Jung's caves, the dark side of each of us, our predatory shadow. This is a 1,000-foot letdown, and that's the trouble with many science fiction novels. When we meet an alien too easy to understand, we're disappointed in the alien and in the novel.
John Leonard reviewed Michael Crichton's new book, Sphere. Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Mary Peacock, the style editor of The Village Voice. She was one of the first to write about fashion in the alternative press. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews new recordings of Arnold Schoenberg's violin and piano concertos. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg looks at the verbal legacy of the hippie culture. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.